Fly motion. Okay, friends. What we want to do, what I want to do is to introduce you partly to the book of Job and the way that the book of Job handles the question of suffering, extreme suffering that people might have. And the actual thing that I'm going to do is a bit of a condensed version. Beginning of last year, the pastor of the church where I go had left, and the other one was on leave, and so the younger generation said, "We want you to take over." And so during Lent, I had a series called Job, Jennifer, and Jesus. That's a part of Lent, a series of. And this is a part of that. And I want to introduce you, if I can, to the book of Job. I've spent my life studying the book of Job, and that's probably what I'm best known for in scholarly circles. Here I'm known for the purple peasantry. So you have to understand, I'm going to very just, but this is an area where I've done a lot of work with the scholarly stuff. But the other side of it is that the book of Job, I believe, offers a way of looking at the question of suffering that's more realistic and helpful than a lot of the things that we've come.
The platitudes?
Absolutely. As we say in Australia, absolutely. Yes. So what I would like to do is to, first of all, to set the scene so that you understand a little bit about the book of Job, and then go into this first chapter. The book of Job, first of all, just so you understand what we're dealing with, as a important thing to understand, the book of Job is not history. It's a magnificent piece of literature. It's like Shakespeare. It's one of the great pieces of literature of the ancient world. And you can study it forever and ever. And it portrays somebody way back in time, long before Abraham, way back in the beginnings. So it's one of the first peoples of time that is asking the fundamental questions. And there are similar stories elsewhere all around the world. The story of Job. The one in Babylon, the one in India. You can find similar stories where somebody is given absolute and total disaster, and then the questions are raised about that. But to grasp the book as a piece of literature, just to start with, you need to know that the book is framed. It's got a frame. And there's chapters 1 and 2, which is the first part of the chain, and chapter 42 is the end of it. It's got a section in the middle, which is chapter 28, which you've got all these chapters where Job and the friends have this great debate. The great debate happens in the middle. Then at chapter 28, the person who's putting this together, the great poet, has this question: what on earth is wisdom? So he explores the question of what wisdom is all about. In other words, as though all this debate's been going on, but there's still this big question: what's it all about? Then there are three chapters in which you get Job's final case presented. Then there is God's answer from the whirlwind here. And then there's the final chapter, which is Job's answer and God's restoration of Job to life. So Job has all these disasters. There's 2 pages of disaster, 39 pages of debate, and 1 page of story at the end again. It's a very carefully constructed piece of literature. So you need to know it's literature of the first order. But it's asking questions which are universal questions. Universal questions that people always ask and have asked and will continue to ask. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this structure. I want to go literally straight into it, but we don't know when it's written. Could have been written in the 8th century before Christ or the 6th century. We don't know. There's not one historical allusion in the entire book. Pure literature. Now, as a piece of literature, however, it's asking the fundamental question. So that's just to set you where. Now, I want to look at the first 2 chapters and get you to understand the story. So you can turn to the chapter and be looking while I'm talking. Bibles are over there on the table. I brought some in. Understand what the nature of the story is. The first thing to understand is this disaster that Job experiences. And to understand the disaster and why it is such a disaster, and the nature and how the author has portrayed this disaster, you start off with the first verses and you get a picture of Job. And to get the scene right, you've got the council of heaven up here, and down below you've got Job, who was initially portrayed in the first verses as a very wise man. And he's very good, and he does nothing, absolutely nothing wrong. And when his children do something wrong, he says, God, I think, or he says, maybe his children have done something wrong in their thinking. So he has a sacrifice even if they think they've done something wrong. So he's very, very good.
He's a righteous guy.
He's super righteous. He's not just righteous, he's super righteous. He's the best, most righteous person you could imagine. So there he is, and he has this perfect man is sitting there down on earth. So you've got a perfect human being at it, all intents. Then comes a meeting in the Council of Heaven. Remember, you and I know what's going on up here, but Job doesn't. It's like a Greek chorus, you know, where the chorus tells you what's happening, but the actors on the stage don't know what's happening. It's very, very much the same concept. Now, they have a council meeting in heaven, and God has all the council people coming, and there's one character who's been wandering all over the earth, and he drops in. He's called the accuser. The accuser, or otherwise, the Satan.
Yes, very good.
Thus Satan is, means the word is the accuser. So his role has been to be God's spy, operating monitor all over earth. He's been wandering all over the place, looking at everything on earth, and the council meets and God says, good morning everybody, has anybody got any report? Oh, by the way, says God, have you noticed this guy Job? Now, I am so proud of this book. He's unbelievable. He's incredible. Right? Job is the super duper person. Right? And God's proud of it. So what does the Satan say to him? What does the Satan do?
Of course he's good.
He says, well, of course he's good. Of course he's good. You know why he's so good? You know why he's such a good bloke? God.
He's blessed him.
Because you keep giving him things. You gave him cows and sheep and businesses and trade routes and children. You've given him everything. No wonder he's such a good guy and loves you. Right? That's what he's saying.
But
he gave you everything. So the accuser says, you've given him everything. So what are we going to do? God says, well, I bet he's going to be good anyway. And Satan says, well, look, I'll bet you. I'll make a wager with you. I'll make a wager with you. You know what a wager is? A bet. If you take everything away, take away his cows, his sheep, donkeys, his caravans, and his business, and all his children, then what?
How about he curses you?
Yeah. So the accuser says, this is the wager. It's very important that you see it as a wager. They're in the council, and this guy's accusing, and he says, look, God, you've gotten away with murder here because you've given him everything. Now you take it away and see what happens. And I'll bet he curses you. And what does God say?
Not you.
It's a deal.
Yeah, you're on.
You're on. Absolutely, you're on. And it's crucial that God falls into what you've got a piece of literature, remember? It's portraying and setting up a scenario.
A trap.
You've set up the trap. God has fallen into the trap. God has now agreed to the deal. And who is going to have to be the innocent sufferer?
Job.
So Job, God then says, okay, and they take away all that he has. Absolutely everything is taken away except his wife, Mrs. Job. And that's the deal. And he takes away four things, all of his. And he's got massive amounts of property. Takes away the property, takes away all his trade, his camels and trade, takes away his children, and takes away his household. He's got nothing left but his wife. Total and complete removal of everything. That's the scene. Now, in that scene, then they all. What does Job say at the end of that scene? After this has all happened and everything's been taken away, then Job says what? This is the key line.
God help me?
No, it would have been nice if he said that. He doesn't. Job says, the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
It's in chapter 1, verse 20.
Right. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In other words,
chapter 1, verse 20.
There go the cows, blessed be the name of the Lord. There go the people, there go my children, blessed be the name of the Lord.
Yeah, there it is.
Now, it's that particular statement that I want to spend just a moment on. That answer, you see, is the pious answer that you expect, is that you should say, or what you call before the platitudes. Now, that answer is crucial for understanding, setting up the reader, to also sucking in the reader, because, oh yes, that's what I want to hear him say, that's what he's supposed to say. So you've got all these literary devices to actually get you caught up in it as well. How terrible, oh how pious, how good he is. And he says it. Now, I have to tell you a story, because partly the reason why I got interested in Job is this story. When I was at the seminary in 1950-something, we came home for Christmas, my brother and I, and it was the day before Christmas. We went to have a game of tennis. We were having this game of tennis about 5 miles from our house. We had an old buckboard of a truck that we drove there, played tennis, and while we were playing tennis, there was a phone call to the house next door, and they said, your house is on fire. We raced home to the buckboard, almost tipped it over. We got there, and here, the whole house was totally in flames. And people started to come from everywhere. We were out in the country. So there were people from everywhere. And the Lutheran pastor came. And he came up to me and he said, Mormon, the Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord.
Oh.
It made a big impression on me. I felt like suck him in the solar plexus. I didn't want to say, blessed be the name of the Lord at that moment. And that is the key to understanding what that particular thing is about at the beginning. One of the key things
is... That's not human nature.
One of the key things is that Job is portrayed at this point as being in denial. Not facing what he's really feeling. Now, I just let us reflect. What are some of the other typical pious answers to disaster or suffering that you hear?
I must have deserved it.
God.
Yes. So one is, I deserved it. I did something to deserve it.
Another one is, God has a plan.
Yes, and it's part of the plan.
We see dimly now, but
huh?
We see dimly
now.
Yes,
but somewhere in the future it will be clear why this disaster happened, but at the moment it's just, what else?
God suffers with you.
Yeah, well, it might be, but that's very late, Elizabeth, and most of the time you don't get that.
When did you suffer?
Huh?
When my nephew died, people in the church said God wanted him for an angel.
Oh, yeah. When children die, that's what is
I live in Bellingham, and the explosion took one of my daughter's classmates. And that classmate's flying to Lutheran by the time he was 2 and a half.
I heard a lot of that. Yep, that's right. Why God wants it for an angel? God took you for
God
it.
Needed a left-handed hitting pitcher.
What else? Yeah.
What did you do?
Yeah, that one. In fact, I deserve it. What did I do to deserve this? I must have done something.
Now, other people will say, what did you do?
Yeah.
To you.
Yeah.
That's
right. Yes, that's right. You are meant to feel.
I don't think people say that so much directly to the sufferer, but they do think that. They think they must have done something.
Yeah. What they do mostly is avoid you.
It could happen to me because I'm not them.
They don't want the bad things that happen to you to rub off.
Avoid. Any others? People here. Huh? Oh. I remember when God did it because God loves you. Never quite figured that out.
Or I heard God will not give you more than you can.
Oh, no. Yes.
Yes, that.
You hear that all?
Not more than you can bear. Yeah, right.
Well, that's what's the answer. What's the response to that is, God, I wish I wasn't so strong.
Any others? See, there's a lot of these pious platitudes. People want to say something to you when you really go through a disaster or through hell or something, and they say something that they heard, and they think it's going to comfort you, but it does just the opposite. And a lot of these sayings, you see, are what I call stage one. And what is clearly stage one in Job, and that is denial. Denial of what it really is about, what it feels like, the hell you're going through, and the like. And Job sets up this denial because Job has no reason to be angry at God tricking him because he doesn't know about the trick. He doesn't know about the wager. So you've got Job in ignorance going through this denial, right? That other dimension is there. All right, now, the story continues, and the problem gets worse. They get back together, and after it's all happened, the heavenly council meets once more, right? And the accuser is once more in the heavenly council, and God is there, and God says, aha, see? Huh? He said, blessed be the name of the Lord, didn't he? Huh? Aha. Uh-huh. And so Satan says, all right, round one to you, God, but if you, what? Attack his body, fill him with boils, make him miserable, then I'll bet he gives you skin for skin. You got to take his body and then he'll curse you to your face. So the next stage is that Job gets boils and all those other things, and he's sitting there scraping himself, and his wife says to him, why don't you
curse God and be done with it?
Curse God and die. And Job comes back with another pious platitude. Another one. You can't believe this. And he says, God has given us good things, we've got to accept the bad things too, right? Ayo, and you say to yourself, how can this possibly be that this guy can keep saying these pious things and the denial keeps going and keeps going? So that is, all of these things are continued. And they are all part of stage one, setting it up for the real Job of the rest of the book. Now, To give you a little further background, I'll tell you the story of Jennifer and the reason that the story says it.
Who's Jennifer?
I'm going to tell you.
Oh, it's not out of the Bible.
It's hidden in the Bible. She was a quiet Christian woman, Jennifer, struggling to make ends meet. She lived in a simple weatherboard house with a rather rough husband. She had a little boy called James. When she worked at night as a waitress at the hotel, her husband looked after the boy, or so she thought. One tragic night, the police came to the restaurant and told her the sad news. He had tried out, the house had been burnt to the ground, and the boy James had been burned alive. He tried to get out of the house, but the door was locked and he could not escape. The husband had apparently gone to the pub hotel for a drink and left the boy in the house, and he had vanished. Jennifer was alone, faced with a senseless and tragic loss of her son, her life, and her home. And the question was, how do you counsel Jennifer? So easy, we start with these pious answers. Another one is, we'll get a fun briefing in heaven and it'll all make sense. You know? She got all those questions and all those pious answers. Another one is, God does it to build our character. Mm-hmm. It's character building. Another one is, all things work together for those who lose things. How do I counsel Jennifer? If I stop at the end of Job 2, I can't do it. I simply can't do it. I've got nothing I can say because I know what the Lutheran pastor said to me, you know, and it doesn't work. The platitudes that are there. So what we move to is stage two. You cannot stay with the denial. People will begin with the denial, and people will offer answers that are in denial. What happens in the book of Job is 7 days Job sits there, and that's the transition from denial to stage two, which is despair. And there are two dimensions to despair. We need to see both of them. And the story of Job carries you through to understand those moments of despair, the dimensions of despair. And what, if you stop at the end of chapter 2 of Job, you are, I'll try to say, your theology is going to be destructive. You must move into the rest of the book to understand how you move from denial through despair to something more. So, chapter 3 is the beginning of the despair of Job. And how does it work out? After 7 days of sitting there, the real Job is portrayed. And the despair has two sides. I'm calling at the moment the outer, the outward, and the inner. How does Job begin his cry of despair? Does he say, blessed?
No.
He says just the opposite, doesn't he? And he screams. I don't like to do it, but we'll break the roof here. Curse the day that I was born. So what you begin with is a despair a screen despair, a despair that's portrayed in terms of a screen. Curse the day I was born, curse my mother's womb, curse all those things. I'm mad as hell, and I'm screaming. And the cursing goes on all through that chapter. He doesn't quite do what the mother, the wife, says. You remember the wife says, curse God, and then that'll be a form of euthanasia. You'll die. God'll have to put you to death, because you're not allowed to curse God. But Job curses everything but God. He doesn't quite curse God, but he curses everything else. Curse the day, curse the date on the calendar. Yeah.
I've never quite understood this.
What does the word curse mean?
What does it mean to, I mean, does it mean,
all right,
does it mean to say, God, I'm angry at you? Is that cursing God? Or?
Last night, you remember, I said that the blessed was, what?
A transfer of power.
Transfer of power, transfer of energy. Mm-hmm. For who?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. To curse is the transfer power for destruction. It's opposite. To write the curse as much as a rite of blessing. To buy transfer, and if I actually go through the rite of curse, it says curse my the calendar and remove it from the days of the year. Curse means
it's like an exorcism kind of?
No one tells it. It's actually bringing in the power rather than taking it out.
Okay.
And if you read it closely, it says, bring on the forces of darkness into this life. Bring on the forces of destruction.
It's a cult.
So when you curse God, what do you...
When you curse God, you are actually invoking the forces of destruction on God, and God automatically comes back and destroys you. It backfires when you curse God. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So pretty much the words to say would be, shall we accept good from God and not trouble?
That's what he says at the beginning.
Yeah.
But when he gets to chapter 3, let me just go, I'll give you a little help to clue on this. Verse 6 says, let those cursed who curse the sea, those who are skilled at stirring up Leviathan, that is stirring up the forces of evil. What I would like, the curse is to stir up the forces of evil. So he is cursing, he is screaming out a right to try and find the forces that will destroy his earth, his birthday, his origins. Now, that didn't make sense to me at first. I'll tell you the next piece of the Jennifer story. Jennifer had a breakdown and was in an institution, and I went to visit her, and she said, I said, you know, how are you getting on? And she said, look, I don't want to live, and but I don't have the courage to commit suicide yet. I said, well, what other option is there? She said, oh, that I had never been born.
No.
No. Precisely what was in the book of Job, and she had not read it. In other words, you are bringing down the forces that would reverse the order of life itself. Oh, that I was never born. Now, the important part is not so much all the language about the curse, but what I would say is crucial for me when I now counsel, if somebody's gone through the disaster of that order, that what Job does is provide you with the right to scream. The right to scream. You sit down and you say, how do you feel? I want to scream at the sky. I want to scream at God. I want to scream at everything.
But the anger is okay. Permission for anger.
Oh, gorgeous. That's what Job does. Job is pissed off. Pardon me. But he is. He's absolutely furious. He is absolutely screaming. total despair. This is despair mixed with anger, mixed with emotion, mixed with confusion, mixed with everything. That's what it is. Because let's face it, he has had everything taken away from him. He's supposed to have a blessed, loving God, and God's tricked him. What's the point of being nice? Not going to help any longer. So the denial turns to despair, but a despair, you can have despair which is totally destructive, or you can allow the despair to be expressed and to get it out, which is far more constructive. So when I would counsel somebody like this, and I said, do you want to scream? I'll have a screaming room. Have a place where you can scream. Somebody you can scream to. You can scream at me. I don't care, because it's going to be healthy in the end. You follow me?
I recommend to people that they scream in their car when they're driving.
Yes. In media, we do that all the time. We scream all the time. Blow the horn. Nobody can hear you. But that's good. Yes. Screaming to God. But there are other places we can go to. And if Job is any kind of model of how the process of coming to terms with whatever's happened, if it's any kind of model, I would say the first thing is the opportunity to scream, which is exactly what I would say to Jennifer or to anybody else in my congregation when if I'm a pastor. And the ways you might do that, if somebody is really, this is somebody who, if sometimes you have people who psychologically disturbed when it becomes a real problem, but you need to know the difference. And when I preached about that, the number of people who came and said, we want to scream. Now, time is up. Your time was?
11:15.
15. Oh, we got plenty of time. Now, what I wanted to do was then to say, this is part one of the whole understanding of despair. Despair can be a chance to let it all out, to let it go, to scream bloody murder, as it were. But there's another side of despair, which is also revealed in this first chapter, chapter 3 of Job. Just turn to chapter 3. I'm going to read a little bit of this so you get a feel for it. Chapter 3, reading from verse 11. Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire? I wish I had been an abortion or a miscarriage. That's what I wish. Why were there knees to receive me, or breasts back on this whole thing? I wish I'd never been born. Now I would be lying down and quiet. I would be asleep, and then I'd be at rest. See, if I had been died as a baby, I'd be in the grave by now. And I wouldn't have to face all this. Then comes this bit. I'd be lying down with the dead. Verse 14, with kings and counselors of earth, who rebuild ruins for themselves, or with princes who have gold or fill their houses. Or why was I not buried like a stillborn child, like an infant that never saw the light? Because there in death what? The wicked cease from troubling, and the weary are at rest. The small of the prisoners are at ease. They don't hear the voice of the taskmaster, the small and the great there, and the slaves are free from their masters. So what is death portrayed as?
Release.
So the other one is the dream of death. The dream of death. That death would be a wonderful place, given what I'm going through. And we call that suicide. So you have here Job at the verge of suicide, wishing he were in the land of the dead, where everything is equal and everyone is free from, and you don't have to be badgered or hurt or bothered by anybody. Death is a wonderful place here. So you get the idealization of how wonderful it would be to die. So Job is going through not only the scream, but also the dreaming about what it would be like to be dead. He's on the verge of suicide. And his wife says, why don't you do it?
That's an encouragement.
He doesn't quite get there. He doesn't quite do it. Then comes the pivotal verse in this whole chapter. Verse 23. Why? This is the big why question. Why is light given to someone who cannot see the way? A way that's been fenced in by God. To understand this verse, Job has moved from here and here to the absolutely fundamental why question that leads you on to the rest of the book. He's in despair, but in the midst of despair, he asks the why question. Why is a human being put on this earth, given life, made alive? Why is a human being alive if that human being has got a fence around him by God puts there, hedged in with a fence, and that fence is such that you can't find a way out? And the word there is way. In Hebrew, that word way means your purpose, your direction, your goal, the way you're supposed to go. Every creature, an animal, or a plant, or a star, or a thunderstorm, everything has its way, its distinctive inner direction. Now, you've got a way, a goal for life, something that's your destiny. Whatever it is, you've got something. You know, whether your name is Joan or Mary, you've got something which is your way. But what's the point of having a way? An eagle knows its way. It knows how what to do. It flies. A rabbit knows what to do. A chipmunk knows what to do. But me, I have no idea what my way is, because God has taken everything away.
Is that the word Derek?
Yes. That's the same fundamental word that's crucial for understanding what we were talking about the other day. In the book, you can't understand the book of Proverbs, and you're in wisdom literature, you see. That's the same word that was used in other places. Everything has its derrick, its inner code. I call it the code, your genetic direction. Everything has it. And wisdom says, I am God's derrick. The code God used to make the world. In Proverbs 8. And a lot of other places. It's a crucial word. It's not just a way along the trail. It's your inner destiny. That which God has programmed into you. Whether it's a bird, or a thunderstorm, or a human being. And Job says, what's the point of being born if I have no idea what my destiny and purpose and goal and direction is? God has blocked my derrick, my way. That's disastrous. So that's the key text, you see. That big question. You've got to know that question to understand the rest of the book and where it's going to go from here. The writer sets you up. Remember, Job still doesn't know that this was a trick by God. He's going to have to figure it out without knowing that setup. That stage. Okay?
That seems to touch on what we commonly deal with day in and day out, is asking the question, what am I most passionate about? What captures my energy? What is it that I'm really here for?
Precisely. Absolutely. That's what the way is. Everybody has one. According to what we call wisdom literature. Wisdom literature is that literature which you find in Proverbs and in Job and Ecclesiastes. It's not the pious literature of the priests.
it's the literature of ordinary everyday people, scribes and wise people, a whole order of society, and a lot of that literature of the wisdom of those people is actually all over the ancient world. You find it in Egypt, you find it in Babylon, you find it everywhere. So Israel copied a lot of it because it's everyday stuff. I'll give you one. Consider the way of the ant, you lazy bones. Nothing personal. Consider the way of the ant, you lazy bones. It's very industrious in summer and hoards up things for the winter. You ought to. It has a way, a distinctive way of operating. If you're an ant, you're not an ant, but you still have a way. You get, and that's wisdom. Anybody could have said, consider the way of the ant. That's not just Israelite, is it? It's universal. And so it's this kind of universal truths that are there. That's why Job is a book about this universal question and questions. What happens if you're supposed to have a way in life and it looks like the whole thing has been
blocked?
Huh?
Blocked.
Absolutely blocked. Clear? Okay. Now,
you got to go all the way to the finale, though, because I need to find out how this comes out.
When we preached, I preached five of sermons on this.
Well, I'll stay late.
There's a long way to go. I preached five sermons, and after 4 weeks, they came and said, How's it end? I'm not hearing the story. So, the story of Jennifer still keeps going. Now, in order to take the next step in this, I need to stop here first. Is this clear? What we've got to a key point then is that in the despair and out of the despair, Job doesn't stay with death, nor does he stay with screaming. He's now going to push the why endlessly and relentlessly for the next 30 chapters. Yeah?
Is having the Derek or the way, in a way, that's an assumption that you have a path that you can
discern,
feel good about, and this is your goal. And this is, but sometimes, is it possible that your way is to wait and listen?
Well, it might be. You may not find the way right. And Job doesn't, Job has to go through hell before he comes to the end of it all.
In a way, the having a way is an invitation to pride.
Only if you have a kind of arrogance about the way, that if you live faithfully according to what you're supposed to be, if you're an eagle and you start, chasing lions, it's silly. You're not living according to what your very essence is. Why is something called your essence?
But he probably, when he had his wealth and he had his intact family and he had his health, assumed that he knew his way.
That's right.
And then everything is taken away from him. He no longer has his way.
He no longer knows what it's meant to be. He was a wise man, a wise sheikh of the ancient world. And if you're a wise sheikh, you're expected to do things this way. Suddenly he's no longer a wise sheikh. All he's got is an ash heap. And three so-called friends that sit beside him.
Is this his wilderness? God calling him back?
Absolutely. This is his real wilderness. That's a good analogy. This is his wilderness. He's taken it out of Egypt. Goods he has and put in the wilderness. And now he has to find his way. It's not going to be the way that he used to have. Okay? Any comment? All right. Yes.
Is that the plan? Is that the way, for example, to have that kind of a challenge, as the way is for him to learn then to direct
it? In this case, it is. I'm not saying everybody's life is to be the same. Your life might be different. But when somebody has a disaster, you don't come along and say, well, it's all going to work out. That person's going to go through hell, and you have to give them the right to go through hell, to scream, and to search, and to search. Don't. If you give them, this is the answer to it, then they don't find their way. You get work, support, and all the rest of it. You're part of the process. Okay? Now, if I take you the next step then and ask the question, well, what? You want to know what goes on?
Yes.
What happened to Jennifer?
I didn't grant me patience.
What happens to Jennifer? And you ask, because this despair, this inner despair, can reach all kinds of depths, proportion. I'll give you the next part of the Jennifer story. Jennifer began to blame herself. Quite cool. I should have known that my husband would go to the pub. I should have been there to rescue my son. I should have stayed at home. That's Dad and I. It's all my fault. I'm a worthless woman. I'm ashamed of myself. I'm ashamed of myself. And even though one can assure her that she wasn't to blame, a sense of guilt and shame ran very, very deep. Why, I wondered, did she feel such shame and worthlessness? In time, she told me another part of her story. When she was about 12 years old, her uncle sexually abused her. Several times he came to babysit for Jennifer's parents and took advantage of her. Once again, Jennifer was not to blame, but like so many women who are raped or abused, they feel that somehow they are at fault. The whole event was so dirty and traumatic, so sick and disgusting, the girl feels an overwhelming sense of shame. Jennifer felt that way too, and probably some in the audience do too. And after a while, after all, one in every three or four women are sexually abused.
That's true here too.
And no exception was Jennifer. And her shame was real. So what you realize is that this sense of shame, this sense of guilt that she carried, goes to another level. And that is the level of extreme shame. And how does that shame, how do you meet that shame? How is that shame to be faced? Because in the chapters now that follow, and I won't go into them until tomorrow, but the chapters that follow, what do the three fins say?
You must have done something.
You must have done something. You
everything has its way, and it was behind it all. An eagle has a way, which is to fly and soar.
And they try to shame him into confessing and admitting. They are powerful forces because they use all the doctrines of the church. Mm-hmm. They list them. I could go through them with friends of, and I could list doctrines that you've heard over. Same question. And I need to give you a little bit of Hebrew. This word way in Hebrew, I'll give you a Hebrew word.